I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Cars are crawling through checkpoints in the Saudi Arabian city of Khobar as a massive manhunt continues for the gunmen in this weekend's killing spree at an office building and residential compound housing mostly foreign oil workers. Al-Qaeda has claimed responsibility for the attack that killed 22 people, 13 in the initial assault, including one oil executive whose body was tied to a car and dragged for a mile before the gunmen returned and rounded up more than 50 hostages, nine of whom were brutally killed. Saudi special forces entered the building 25 hours after the assault began. The leader of the attackers is in custody. His three accomplices escaped. Waleed Kaddouri is editor-in-chief of the Middle East Economic Survey. He joins us from Nicosia, Cyprus. And Waleed, this is the second such attack in a month. The last one caused an exodus of oil workers from Saudi Arabia. Will this one have the same effect?
Well, I wouldn't call it an exodus. Most of the oil industry in Saudi Arabia is done by Saudi Aramco and Saudi employees. The service companies, the engineering companies, and some of the new contracts by foreign companies do have the foreign workers, as far as the oil industry is concerned.
Yeah, but there's a large number of foreign workers. We hear that Saudi Arabia relies on six million expatriate workers to help run its oil industry.
That's true.
Yeah.
But they are not in the oil industry. Most of them are in other sectors.
Related. Yeah.
We have not heard of an exodus. What we are hearing about here, at least in the Middle East, that expatriates are thinking of relocating their families, their wives and children, and that kind of thing so far.
Well, oil is already at historic highs. Markets were jittery before this weekend. Oil traders in the U.S. and Britain are on vacation today. Are there any signs of how this might be impacting the oil industry?
Well, I don't think oil price will go down, that's for sure. It's, as far as oil is concerned, I mean, the fundamentals, there is more than ample physical crude oil in the market. The problem is the worry about the security in the Middle East, or lack of security in the Middle East, both in Saudi Arabia now and in Iraq. There is a difference, I think, one has to make. So far, there have been, other than in Iraq, there have been no attacks on oil facilities. First of all, and under normal circumstances, they are well protected. In the last few months, year or two, they have been extra protected. And they are not in the cities. Oil facilities, because of the location of the oil, is away from the cities, either in the desert or by the coast, separated, isolated from the city. And it's not an open area that people can go in. I mean, it's already isolated and defended.
Of all the questions that attacks like this raise for people like yourself who watch the industry, is one of them the stability of the royal family?
I don't think the Qaeda policy, the way I see it, whether in, not just in Saudi Arabia and other countries, they are not really, they have not targeted the ruling regimes. What they are trying to do is shake the relationship with the U.S., hurt U.S. interests, attack expatriates. They don't have the public support. Actually, there is a backlash against them for what they are doing. They don't have the mass support, the public support, the political organization to really topple regimes or weaken the regimes, whether in Saudi Arabia or other Arab countries. So what they do, that is destruction and terror. But that doesn't mean changing regimes. What they are doing, though, by killing expatriates, nationals, other Arabs, by destroying facilities, they are really isolating themselves more and more from the public. If there was any support, it's backfiring.
I asked you, Waleed, about the effect on the expat workers in Saudi Arabia of this attack, but we note that there were eight Indians killed, three Filipinos, three Saudis, two Sri Lankans, an American, a Briton, an Italian, a Swede, a South African, and an Egyptian boy. What's been the impact on the workers around the world observing this?
Some of these people who were killed have been serving in the region and these companies for at least two decades. And then some of them have really contributed greatly, talking from personal, you know. And it's a big loss, and the way it was done is barbaric, and the whole reason for it, you know, killing civilians is terrorism. And you know, people are sorry, and what can one say? It's a very sad situation.
Yeah. Dr. Kaddouri, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Dr. Waleed Kaddouri is editor-in-chief of the Middle East Economic Survey. He spoke to us from Nicosia, Cyprus. There are good economic numbers out of Russia today. The trade surplus is up, as is the average Russian's disposable income. But the numbers belie serious problems in a country still struggling to transform Soviet institutions into a real democracy. And that is especially true of the police. David Filipov is the Boston Globe Moscow correspondent. He joins us to talk about what Russians are calling werewolves in uniform and on efforts to crack down on police corruption. Welcome, David.
Hi, Robin.
And first of all, who are these werewolves in uniform, and what are they doing?
Well, werewolves in uniform is the term Russians use to describe any police who are, instead of protecting and serving, setting up protection rackets and extorting.
Is it just extortion?
Extortion, bribery, sex rings, any kind of crime that organized criminals can do, these police have allegedly committed and are committing.
In fact, a Russian magazine published a price list last year that you quote in your article today for police services, such as planting heroin on someone, arresting them, even traffic tickets.
That's right. According to this very influential magazine, Mergers and Acquisitions, apparently wealthy businessmen who want to get rid of a competitor can use the police, can basically hire them to commit various different acts. And for a fee, they'll do all kinds of things, prosecutors as well, courts as well.
David, tell me, what proportion of Russians are affected by this? Is this a class issue? Who gets affected by this?
In a recent study, 26% of the people who responded said that they'd been harassed, brutalized, abused by the police. So it's happening to one out of every four Russians. But everyone has an attitude about it because when there's a problem, where do you go? Can you go to the police, whom you don't trust, or where else?
How much is this costing the Russian people?
Well, someone has estimated that the overall price of corruption a year is $39 billion, which is an incredible figure. But as far as the police's role in it is concerned, any officer that can see a chance to earn some money has a very big incentive to do so because police are notoriously underpaid and they have a lot of power. So they have a lot of opportunities to accept money for things that they're supposed to be doing or things they're not supposed to be doing. And it was the police themselves who told me that they're doing business rather than solving crimes.
Why are they paid so little, and what has Russian President Vladimir Putin done about this?
Well, police are paid so little because there are too many of them. Just like anything else in a formerly socialist economy and in a former police state, you need a lot of police. So there are 1.5 million police officers of various types running around. They all need to be paid, and there isn't money to pay them all a decent salary. And in general, in Russia, people don't make enough money. So as a result, they're earning, you know, $150 a month, which is nowhere near the amount that they can earn by just taking bribes. Mm. And Putin maybe would like to do something about it, but he can't slash the amount of police to the amount that you need. He can't retrain them. He can't retrain their officers who resist any kind of change. And he can't retrain the senior commanders who like the idea that they've got this huge, massive force that nobody can do anything about.
Any bright spot on the horizon here, David?
Well, there are people in the Ministry of Interior, which oversees the police, who know all this, and they want to improve. But right now they're in the minority. As long as they are, it's going to be a long battle for Russia to solve.
Well, David, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
David Filipov, Boston Globe correspondent, speaking to us from Moscow. President Bush laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknowns at Arlington National Cemetery today as the nation observes Memorial Day. Speaking later, he praised the men and women who have given their lives during times of war.
Through our history, America has gone to war reluctantly because we have known the costs of war. And the war on terror we're fighting today has brought great costs of its own. Since the hour this nation was attacked, we have seen the character of the men and women who wear our country's uniform in places like Kabul and Kandahar, in Mosul and Baghdad. We have seen their decency and their brave spirit. Because of their fierce courage, America is safer. Two terror regimes are gone forever, and more than 50 million souls now live in freedom.
Meanwhile, presumptive Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry is in Portsmouth, Virginia, where he's participating in the city's 120th annual Memorial Day parade. And this morning, veterans marched through the streets of the nation's capital as thousands of onlookers waved flags and cheered. That parade capped off an emotional weekend of remembrances, which included the opening of the new World War II Memorial. Jack Zahora covered the opening of the memorial for Public Radio's WAMU in Washington, D.C. Jack's on the line. Jack, first of all, did that event this past weekend live up to its expectations?
Well, I think according to the World War veterans, it has. They said it was a beautiful ceremony. Again, the big refrain from most of the veterans is that even though it was great, they wish their brother who had fought in the war, or perhaps a friend of theirs who is sick right now in a hospital, could have seen it, that the memorial, even though wonderful, was 60 years a little bit too late.
Hmm. Well, meanwhile, to today's news, John Kerry is attending a parade in Portsmouth, Virginia. Some see that as a political move, since Kerry is advertising heavily there. Virginia is considered a solidly Republican state. We're reminded, first of all, to ask you, how politicized was this weekend's dedication for either President Bush or for Kerry? How were they received?
Well, I think that there wasn't anything said straight out. But in the president's speech, he didn't mention Iraq, and he didn't mention the war on terrorism. He did mention, however, the trials and tribulations during World War II that the soldiers felt as the Nazis marched into Paris, and how that the war at times felt uncertain. And I think the implication there was that even during these times when the war in Iraq is becoming a little bit more difficult, that people need to come together and just stick it out, so to speak. Mm. And Kerry, of course, was a little bit more of a harsher tone. He wasn't speaking at the memorial, but in his weekly radio address with the Democrats, he criticized the war on terrorism and President Bush and said that we won World War II in part because of the alliances we had with other countries. And it was time to rebuild those alliances for our troops. He even went out as far as to say that currently those alliances have been shredded.
Mm. What about the people in the crowd themselves? Was there much talk from them about the war in Iraq?
A little bit. A few veterans said that they were very proud of what the president was doing and how he was handling the situation, and referred to a few of their own stories to tell me that, indeed, in times of war, things always do look bleak until the end. A few others said they wish they had someone such as Truman or FDR back in the White House. They were a little bit more critical about how the president is handling it. Mm-hmm. And actually, the big notion I got, as far as politically speaking, wasn't about war at all. It was about issues like health care and Medicare and that type of thing.
Mm. For soldiers?
Yes, for veterans in particular, veterans' benefits. I even spoke with a Filipino delegation who was upset because right after the war they received veterans' benefits, and about a year later they don't.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Jack, thank you.
Thank you.
Jack Zahora is a reporter for WAMU Radio in Washington, D.C.
When they buried him in the ground so cold, they dressed him in.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. On February 19, 1991, during the first Gulf War, United States Air Force pilot Jeff Fox was shot down over Iraq. Badly injured, he was captured by Iraqi forces and taken to an Iraqi prison, where he was held under dreadful conditions for 15 days. He was deprived of his Geneva Convention rights and repeatedly tortured. Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Fox, now retired, joins us from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thanks.
Well, first of all, it is Memorial Day. What does Memorial Day mean for you? I'm wondering how you're feeling on this day in particular.
Well, I always think of all the servicemen and women who are, you know, over there right now and serving our nation. And I think also of my father, who was in the United States Army for 26 years, my uncle, my older brother, and my younger brother, who was also in the Air Force, and we were all pilots. So I always... brings a lot of thoughts to my mind. Mm.
Can you tell us how you were treated when you were a prisoner of war in Iraq during the first Gulf War? I mean, there's some horrendous conditions.
Well, whenever you were transported, you were always handcuffed and blindfolded, and I was kept in the trunk of a car. I bet you for several hours, where if you had to go to the bathroom, which I did, you just went to the bathroom in your pants, and I had no idea where we were or what was going on. And whenever you were in a cell, they would come in routinely and literally just place you on a chair and beat you. And during one of those occasions, I had my right eardrum broken. And
we understand you were in solitary confinement in a very small concrete cell, broken toilet, one blanket, thin red soup for meals.
That's correct. You didn't have access to anything, any water or toilets. You literally went to the bathroom there, or I did several times in my boot and tried to pour it out the window. There was no toilet paper. There was nothing.
Mm-hmm. A lot of physical abuse, as you mentioned, hit with rubber mallets, batons, kicked in the groin. And as awful as all of that was, I'm wondering if the psychological aspect of it, I mean, not knowing what was going to happen, was worse.
Well, that's a good question, because every time you would hear someone walking down the hall, you know, I could just tell your heart rate would go up and you were wondering whether or not that person was going to stop at your cell. And if they did, as soon as they opened the door, the first thing I did was look at their hands. And if they had a chain or a rope, oh, my God, I'm going somewhere. Mm-hmm. But if they had a little bowl or something, they were coming to feed you. So mm-hmm. You're right. And you could look outside the building and down. On one occasion, I saw this one. It's like an Arab gentleman was being beaten with sticks. He was tied to a pole, and it was just, you were wondering whether or not that was going to, whether they were coming to get you.
Well, I wonder, given that you were a POW in Iraq, what was your reaction when you saw the pictures of the way that U.S. troops had treated a number of prisoners in Abu Ghraib?
Well, it was a little, quite frankly, it was, when I saw that, I was a little shocked at first, because it's inappropriate, it's humiliating, and it should not have been done. And quite frankly, I was surprised that that would have taken place. I can see, you know, Iraqis doing some of that, but not our, you know, not some of our troops. But when I do see the pictures, I realize that it is, in my humble opinion, it is humiliating. It is not, you know, torture, if you will.
Hmm? What do you mean by that?
Well, when I think of torture, I think of being handcuffed and, like I say, blindfolded and being beaten with rubber mallets for 5 or 10 minutes, or being literally thrown down the stairs or spit on, or having your eardrum broken.
But Jeffrey, most of these soldiers were handcuffed and had hoods over their heads, and many were beaten, and you know, some died.
Well, if that is the case, then you're right, Robin. That would have to be as classified as torture.
Yeah. And how do you feel about that?
Well, it's inappropriate, and the individuals who did that should be punished under the Uniform Code of Military Justice.
Mm. And I'm wondering, too, if you were also aware of what, you know, you being so aware of what could happen to an American soldier if he was taken, because it was done to you. I mean, didn't these U.S. soldiers, in fact, jeopardize other U.S. soldiers?
Well, you know, in all honesty, if you're an American soldier and you are captured by Iraqi folks over there, you're in trouble, because I do not think that they comply at all with the Geneva Convention or anything that's appropriate or proper.
I guess what I'm saying now is that they can say, and see, neither does the U.S.
Right. Well, they can do that. And in all honesty, there's just a few soldiers. I don't think that that's indicative of what, you know, the whole military does, and that is not normal for the American military.
Mm. You were one of 17 American POWs who sued the Iraqi government for financial compensation for what you endured. Do you think the reverse should happen? Do you think Iraqis should be able to sue the U.S.?
Well, you know, part of me says that, okay, I don't have any problem with, okay, they were mistreated, compensate them. But the problem that I have, as well as the other POWs, is, okay, we are offering them assistance financially for the mistreatment, but we are being told that we cannot have money from a terrorist nation for torture that they did to us. Mm. And it's quite frankly, it's a little frustrating and confusing.
Well, especially since that nation really doesn't exist in some ways now, so in effect it's the U.S. government, right, telling you that you can't have the compensation?
Oh, that's right, because
yeah.
the money that the judge awarded to us was Iraqi money that was held in a bank. It was frozen funds. But the president released that money to go to rebuild Iraq, and now the Justice Department is essentially saying, well, since there's no money there, the judgment should be thrown out.
Mm.
So it's frustrating.
So the money that was awarded you was taken by, released by President Bush to rebuild the country of your captives.
That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah. Well, Jeffrey, you were saying that on this Memorial Day, you're thinking a lot about the soldiers in Iraq. What about the soldiers coming back? Your thoughts on, you know, they're also reentering.
Well, I thank them for what they've done because they're doing the best that they can to help preserve our freedoms. And my hat's off to them, and I wish them the best.
Hmm. Well, Jeffrey, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Retired United States Air Force pilot Jeffrey Fox. Stay with us. More ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If you live in one of those states that's up for grabs in the November presidential election, Ohio or Michigan, just to name two, you have already seen tons of TV ads from the Bush and Kerry campaigns, and you may have noticed the negative trend. A new study by the Washington Post found that 3/4 of the ads from the Bush camp attack John Kerry, 27% of Kerry's attack the president. But in this war of words, how many of the attacks are true? To find out, we decided to call Brooks Jackson, director of the website factcheck.org, a nonpartisan watchdog group which goes through political ads line by line. We asked him for a review, starting with an excerpt of a commercial from the Bush-Cheney re-election committee. It's called Wacky.
Some people have wacky ideas, like taxing gasoline more so people drive less. That's John Kerry. He supported a 50-cent a gallon gas tax.
Okay, Brooks Jackson, did John Kerry support a 50-cent a gallon gas tax?
Robin, it is true that 10 years ago, according to two yellowing newspaper clips, Kerry once said that he had previously supported a 50-cent a gallon gasoline tax. The fact is, there was a bill in the Senate that he never co-sponsored. He never voted for it, doesn't support it now, and hasn't, so far as anybody can tell, for a decade.
But the ad worked. According to an Annenberg poll, 46% of those polled believe Kerry voted to raise gasoline taxes 350 times by 50 cents a gallon. Where did that 350 times come from?
That's a different ad, and it talks about more than 350 votes by Kerry for higher taxes. The fact is, when you look at the documentation that the Bush campaign puts out, they have a list of 350-plus votes. What they're talking about is whenever Kerry voted against a tax decrease, in other words, to hold taxes where they are, they would call that a vote for higher taxes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he would vote for a Democratic tax cut that was an alternative to a larger Republican tax cut. They would call that vote for a tax cut a vote for higher taxes.
So it's safe to say the Bush camp has played a little loose with the truth there. But let's look now at the Kerry camp. Let's listen to the Jobs ad. I know you know this one, too.
While jobs are leaving our country in record numbers, George Bush says sending jobs overseas makes sense for America.
So, Brooks Jackson, ad fact checker, did President Bush say sending jobs overseas makes sense?
No, George Bush never said that. Now, they would have been okay in that ad if they'd said the Bush administration says sending jobs overseas makes sense, because the president's chief economist had a chapter in a big annual report of the Council of Economic Advisers that made the case that sending low-cost jobs overseas makes sense. In the totality of world trade, it ends up benefiting the workers in the U.S. The president never said it. I'd be surprised if he even read it.
Is this a case, do you think, where, you know, a very complicated issue such as outsourcing is hard to get across in a 30-second ad? Or do you think it's a more outright attempt to mislead the public?
No, I think you put your finger on it. As long as we're stuck with 30-second TV ads as the dominant form of political communication, there's really a lot of pressure on campaigns to oversimplify and sometimes just push facts beyond where they'll really go. The campaigns are trying to zap their opponent as effectively as they can, and often they go over the line.
Well, okay, onward. Let's listen to another ad from the Bush camp. This one is called Patriot Act.
President Bush signed the Patriot Act, giving law enforcement vital tools to fight terrorism. John Kerry, he voted for the Patriot Act, but pressured by fellow liberals, he's changed his position. While wiretaps, subpoena powers, and surveillances are routinely used against drug dealers and organized crime, Kerry would now repeal the Patriot Act's use of these tools against terrorists.
Okay, Brooks, would John Kerry repeal the Patriot Act use of tools against terrorists?
No. What John Kerry has said, and you can read it right on his website, is that he would amend those powers, bring about greater safeguards for such things as sneak and peek warrants, where federal agents can, with a judge's permission, go into your house without notifying you, monitor your keystrokes on your computer, search your house, and you'd never know it. Kerry wants a 7-day limit on that. You'd have to be notified after 7 days that your house had been searched, and that could be extended indefinitely if a judge found a continuing need for secrecy. So he would narrow it somewhat. And by the way, as for liberals pressuring him to do that, there are 5 Republican senators who are co-sponsoring the same legislation that Kerry is.
Well, I want to hear as many as is possible. Let's listen to another one. It's not from either team, but it's from a group in Florida that endorsed John Kerry, the League of Conservation Voters. Let's listen.
As you can see, there is no ambiguity in my position on drilling off the coast of Florida.
There sure isn't. President Bush opened up Florida's coast to offshore drilling, and he supported an energy bill that could lead to even more. Well, what would you expect from a Texas oil man?
We at factcheck.org found that ad to be quite misleading. The fact is that the Clinton administration first put in motion a proposal that would have allowed drilling within 16 miles of Florida's coastline at one point way up west of Pensacola. The Bush administration at first was going to go forward with that Clinton-era proposal. Then after an outcry arose, they amended it. And what eventually was put in place is a measure that's going to allow drilling no closer than 100 miles from any point on Florida's coast.
So the line that they used, President Bush opened up Florida's coast to offshore drilling.
They're off base by 100 miles.
Mm-hmm. Well, Brooks, I know your motto is, you know, just the facts, ma'am. But can you quantify for us which side seems to do this more? They both do it.
Well, Robin, I try to stay away from that because what we do here is we try to assess each factual claim on its own merits and let the chips fall where they may. So far, I haven't tried counting up the chips on either side, and I just think it would get in the way of doing my job if I tried to at this point.
Yeah. Brooks, you've done a lot of listening. Is it more misleading in this election than in others?
Well, certainly no less. This campaign started earlier, a month earlier than it has in the past. There's more money being spent here, so what misleading statements there are certainly being repeated more and more than in past campaigns.
From your expert vantage point, what would you call this? I mean, we're used to sort of a subtext, but this is beyond subtext.
When our polling turns up the fact that even people who say they're not getting much information from these ads then say that, yes, it's they think it's probably true that John Kerry voted 350 times for higher taxes, or that Bush said it makes sense to send jobs overseas, ideas they could only have gotten from those ads, what I think that shows is that even people who think these ads aren't affecting them are having false information implanted in their brains almost without their knowledge. It's kind of beyond subliminal, and I'm not quite sure what to call it.
Well, Brooks, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Brooks Jackson is director of FactCheck.org, a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. Still to come, a quickie primer on grilling, and from Bob Dylan to Toby Keith, today's songs about war, for and against. You're listening to Here and Now. Much has been made, as it should be, of the dedication of the World War II Memorial, the more than 16 million Americans who served in that conflict, the more than 400,000 who died in it. Well, here's a moment to note those who are somewhere in between.
Didn't you fight in the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, yeah, me and several hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there by yourself.
Yeah, all over the hell of them. Yeah, that was sort of cold weather. A lot of snow.
People often ask me about my uncle, Lachlan McLachlan Field. You might remember he led us on a road trip to see Vermont's annual snow geese migration 2 years ago. At the time, I said I was in a rush to get there because the sight of those all-white birds against the dark Vermont sky was so fleeting. If you were late, you'd miss it. But that was a big lie. It was my uncle I was afraid to miss after he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Ah, so have you been following all the news? Fighting in Afghanistan and...
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting. It's been going on for years.
Uncle Locke was a career officer in the Army. His wife, Martha, was an Army nurse. Legend has it they carried their firstborn in a backpack across Europe. He fought in the Battle of the Bulge, helped liberate concentration camps.
It's always moving, seems like. Then you had to do overseas tours, and families couldn't go everywhere.
I know more about my uncle's military service than my own father's, because after my father died, I swore I'd learn more about the remaining member of our family's greatest generation and started calling my uncle every Memorial Day just to talk. When I first asked him, "What did you do in the war?" he was stunned. He said, and I'll never forget this, he said, "No one has ever asked me that before. My cousins hadn't, I hadn't of my own dad. You just didn't talk about those things back then." And my uncle told me about a time he gave his teenage grandson some snapshots he took of a concentration camp to take to school, sort of like show and tell. Everyone got upset, so he just thought no one wanted to hear about it. And now it's too late. Yesterday I made my annual call to Uncle Locke. I didn't expect much, but now I was stunned. While he occasionally had to be reminded who I was, and at one point couldn't remember his beloved late wife, an impossibility before the cruelty of Alzheimer's, he did perk up when I mentioned the new memorial. "Well, that's not for me," he said. "I'm alive." And he proceeded to talk about Joe Edwards, a Boston guy, and Mal Morgan, a Southerner, both battery commanders with him during the war. And he thanked me so much for thinking about him. What was my name again? Just a reminder on this Memorial Day of the thousands of soldiers who have not yet died, but are fading away.
Oh, my gosh. Hundreds, thousands of them. Uncle Locke, look. Thousands.
Around.
Yeah. Oh, maybe they'll come this way. Here they come.
All thanks to the memory of all you flying men. We can't remember when we've had more royal treatment. Hope you'll soon be back again. And thank you so much. Oh, thanks for the memory of pilots zooming planes through navigators' lanes. You gunners, ground crews, bombardiers who further freedom's gains. We thank you so much. Bonds are a way most effective to help these men reach their objective. Look ahead with a freedom perspective.
There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Memorial Day is a day for reflection, but it also marks the unofficial start of summer and getting reacquainted with the grill. Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Guntz is on the line with some last-minute grilling tips. Kathy, if you want to grill today, is it too late to marinate the food, of course?
Not at all. Marinades work for 5 minutes. It's just, you know, if you use citrus or soy sauce, it will relax the muscles in food, and it just gives it that little bit of a more of a tender touch, and it can be really effective. If you have an hour, great, but 5 minutes, it'll help.
Okay. How about, you speak of relaxed. Sometimes my fish is too relaxed. How do you keep fish from falling through the grill?
You know, anything that you're grilling, small pieces of chicken, small pieces of fish, shrimp, throw it on a skewer, because then the little pieces won't fall off. Put it on a skewer. If worse comes to worse, put it on a piece of tin foil and punch some holes through it so the heat can come up, but it'll protect it from falling through.
Okay. What do you want us to know about grilling today?
What I want you to know is that if you're firing up your grill for the first time this season, clean it.
Yeah.
All those little bits and pieces that have accumulated all winter in your garage are going to burn your food. Get your grill very, very hot. The biggest mistake people make is that they think they have to get the charcoal boiling hot and then cook everything really fast over an intense fire. Sometimes indirect slow heat can be far more effective.
How do you know how hot it is? Is it by the color of the coal?
It's by the color of the coal, but put your hand there, and if you can't keep it there for more than 3 or 4 seconds, it is really, really hot, and that's fine for a burger or something. But if you're grilling chicken or fish, push all the coals over to one side and then cook your meat or your fish over on the other side, and what happens is that it grills, it gets all the great flavor, but it doesn't burn, and it's way, way juicier.
Here now is resident chef and emergency grilling tipster Kathy Gunst. She spoke to us from her home in Maine.
How many roads must a man walk down before they call him a man?
Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, sung by Peter, Paul, and Mary, the bellwether of protest in the 60s. Now, fast forward to today.
I'm an American soldier, an American. Beside my brothers and my sisters, I will proudly take a stand. When liberty's in jeopardy, I will always do what's right. I'm out here on the front lines, sleep in peace tonight.
Toby Keith's patriotic anthem, American Soldier. War has inspired songs for and against forever. And here in Elsevier, critic Scott Allard joins us with a sampling. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Robin. Great to be here.
And Scott, you've been telling me you're hearing more protest songs in folk. It's not surprising, folk and protest. Mm-hmm. But how are these songs different from the Vietnam-era songs?
Well, one of the myths about the Vietnam era was that there were a lot of folk songs that came out very quickly. Just as the war escalated, the tone of the songs from that period escalated. You have to remember that Lyndon Johnson was a real darling of the left after becoming president and passing the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Bill, and launching the War on Poverty. It really wasn't until 1965 that the first song came out that directly blamed LBJ for the escalating war. Tom Paxton's song, Lyndon Johnson Told the Nation, still quite tame compared to what we're hearing today. Just a little over a year into this war, the tone is angry and sharply critical and bitterly personal. Here's a great young string band called the Mammals attacking President Bush for what they perceive as this patrician sense of entitlement in a great political song called the Bush Boys.
Rich men gotta go to the moon. Next, they want to be president too. Pay the piper, but you don't get caught. You won't believe what the Bush boys bought. Hush, little baby, don't you cry. Daddy's gonna buy you an alibi. If that alibi don't work, Daddy's gonna bribe the county clerk.
The Mammals singing the Bush boys, Scott Alaric. I do feel, though, that there are so many songs today for the war. I'm thinking of some of the popular country tunes, you know, like Let Freedom Ring mm-hmm. and such. The right, or those who support a war, have had their voices as well then
yeah.
and now.
Yeah, I think they tend to be much more mainstream voices, which may be just a reflection of the fact that folk music very rarely cracks into the commercial mainstream. And pop music, by and large, has been apolitical, where country music has. But there are big parallels with the 60s, too. In the 1960s, it was Merle Haggard who really spoke up for what was then called the silent majority of conservatives, who didn't feel that they were getting their voices heard over the din of folk music. Two songs really exemplified that, the Okie from Muskogee, where he really, in the best folk tradition, he was speaking up for people who weren't getting their stories told. I'm proud to be an Okie from Muskogee, a place where even squares can have a ball.
We still wave old glory down at the courthouse.
And white lightning's still the biggest thrill of all.
And this was a huge hit. This was played all over mainstream radio.
Yes, it was, and led to a very different kind of song that he did as a follow-up called The Fight Inside of Me, which he has since disowned and said he's ashamed of having written because it was very jingoistic, very confrontational. If you're running down our country, you're walking on the fight inside of me. Today, the self-appointed Merle Haggard figure is clearly Toby Keith. Now, his persona is very fight inside of me. Very confrontational. But when you actually listen to the songs he's singing, he comes much more from the Merle Haggard tradition that really traces back to Woody Guthrie. In a song like this, American Soldier, it's impossible for anybody to really disagree with what he's saying.
And I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost.
Toby Keith singing American Soldier from his new album, which is called Shockin' Y'all.
Yeah.
Little play on shock and awe. But remind us who Toby Keith is.
Toby Keith is a country songwriter and a very big mainstream country star who's very confrontational in his personal style. But again, I think when you listen to what he's actually saying, it's a lot more thoughtful than a lot of people give him credit for.
Right. As you just said, you might be against the war in Iraq, but not against the soldier who is fighting it, and that's where everyone might like that song.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Well, today's folk songwriters, as you said right here before, seem so introspective. They're personal. We've pointed out they're less political in a lot of ways than other eras. So how are they taking up protest music?
That's the most fascinating thing to listen to, Robin, because it is very much a sort of confessional style that's popular today. And they've been having trouble figuring out just how to translate that into a growing sense of political and social commitment. A great example is a New Mexico songwriter named Eliza Gilkison, who's been described as being new agey, both as a compliment and and as a critique. Yeah. Very intimate style. And she's written a song that I think is very much a blown in the wind for our times and one of the finest political songs I've ever heard, precisely because she takes that very intimate stance, almost a self-involved stance of the brooding, angsty folk pop songwriter, and ties that to this growing sense of political consciousness that she feels is almost thrust upon her. She begins the song depicting a young terrorist walking into a shopping mall. Then she sings about children swimming in a toxically polluted pool. But then, and this is the real power of the song, she brings it home to people like us indulging in the supreme luxury of believing that the world's troubles are not our own, and how suddenly that's changed.
Across the world she holds her loved ones to her chest, lays them down and listens at the door. Everybody safe and warm among the truly blessed. How can we even dare to ask for more? Tender mercies.
New Mexico's Eliza Gilkison singing Tender Mercies. And Scott, it's striking me that I'm not hearing this song anywhere.
Yeah, I think 40 years ago this would have been recorded by a half a dozen groups and two or three would have had chart hits with it. But songs like this really aren't being heard in mainstream music today.
Well, Scott, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Always a pleasure.
Here and Now's folk music reviewer, Scott Alaric.
Shine now, all your tender mercies. It's every mother's prayer.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
It's every mother's prayer.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.